First case on our calendar, 03-135, State of Ohio versus William Sapp. Mr. Gamzo.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, counsel. Excuse me. We've raised 16 propositions of law. With the court's indulgence, what I'd like to do is focus primarily on the fifth proposition of law dealing with the course of conduct specification this morning. In this case, there were alleged to be, and Mr. Sapp was convicted of, three aggravated murders and one attempted aggravated murder. Each of the aggravated murders was accompanied by a course of conduct specification addressing each of the other aggravated murders and the attempted aggravated murder. It's our position, the very short version of this, it's our position that, in fact, the course of conduct specification properly applies only to the first two of the murders that are charged, the murders of the two girls, that it is not, in fact, properly applied to either the attempted aggravated murder or to the aggravated murder of Belinda Anderson. And I want to talk about why for a minute and then why I think it makes a difference. This court has never explained, and the revised code does not define course of conduct, and this court, for the significant number of course of conduct cases that have come before it, has never actually defined the boundaries of that term. Court has said, for instance, the course of conduct is multiple murders as part of a, quote, continuing course of criminal conduct. Well, yeah, but that doesn't really tell us very much. The court said that the course of conduct is that which the term fairly describes, which doesn't tell us very much either. So the question is really, what are the boundaries of that? And what we see if we look at this case, the murders of the two girls, that's easy. They occurred at the same time, same place. Two girls, 111, 112, horrible crimes. We're never going to dispute that. Same time, same place, same method. Everything about those two go together, no question. It is then a span of somewhat over a year before we get to the next aggravated murder, the murder of Belinda Anderson. And in that case, what we have is not a girl. Not a young girl, we have an older woman. The means of killing are not the same. The body is held differently. The two girls were left essentially out in the open, not in a place that people were just naturally going to come upon, but out in the open where they could reasonably be found with flats tossed on top of them. They were not fully hidden, certainly. Belinda Anderson was actually buried in a garage. The girls were killed as part of a gang attack. Ms. Anderson, there's no evidence to indicate any such thing. Hazel Pearson, the attempted aggravated murder, 3 months after Belinda Anderson, once again, a woman, an adult, different in form, manner, from the killings of the girls. Now, I know the court has found that a course of conduct doesn't necessarily mean, and I understand this, it's not part of, it doesn't have to be part of the same transaction. That's the multiple murder end of it, perhaps. But there is nothing in this court's jurisprudence. There is no case that has a span of time between killings that we have, as we have in this case, where this court has found, where there has actually been a course of conduct issue in front of this court. We've never had it. We've never had it where the means and manner and circumstances of the killing are so different. Now, what the Court of Appeals said, what the prosecutor argued in the Court of Appeals, argues in its brief here, is, well, you know, but there were similarities in modus operandi, that he similarly cut clothing in an identifiable pattern. that in each case he attempted to do something, at least, to conceal bodies, albeit not the same thing. I want to suggest that there is a difference between a modus operandi, a method of doing a crime, and a course of conduct, that those are not the same thing, that when you have a span of time, as you do here, that separates events, when you have differences in venue, in the nature of the victims, in the circumstances of the crime, that this is not a full course of conduct. The two girls, yes. The other cases, no. And here's why that matters. Because on its face, but here's why it matters. When it came time, the jury found him guilty, of course, of each of the course of conduct specifications. And when it came time to figure out how to weigh all this, how to weigh the aggravation against the mitigation, one of the things the prosecutor explained in detail to the jury is that the number of bodies matters. The number of people who are involved in that course of conduct makes a difference. That it is worse, and reasonably so, to have a course of conduct that results in a whole lot of people being dead than a course of conduct that results in than just killing one person. It is worse, although the prosecutor didn't say this, it is worse to kill 168 people at the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City than it is to kill one person. It is a graver offense somehow without diminishing the horror of what
is there a time limit on a course of conduct?
I'm sorry?
Do you see that there is a time limit on a course of conduct?
The court has never specifically put one there, and I'm not sure I want to say that by itself a time limit is necessarily going to I wouldn't want to draw a line. I wouldn't want to say 10 months is no good. You've found cases where a course of conduct ran over 3 months.
Well, in your view, are you suggesting that the time limitation between these events is such that it is not part of a course of conduct?
I think that's portion
of why it's
not part of
a course of conduct. Is that your argument or not? I'm trying to understand.
It's not entirely the time limitation. I think the time limitation is one thing. The time span, I should say, is one thing.
Well, in the Dahmer case, was that a course of conduct in your judgment?
I'm sorry, the which case?
The Dahmer case. Was that a continuing course of conduct that he had engaged in over a period of time? Or were those spatially separate, not course of conduct events, in your view?
I think that those were, there we have a repeated sequence that, I mean.
Well, isn't this a repeated sequence of dead people?
Well, there's this big gap in the sequence here. There's this big, big gap.
That's why
in the
I
sequence.
Asked you, is time limitation important?
And
you
and
said.
And I'm saying it's, I agree, it is important. Yes, it is important. I'm not going to try and give you a bright line date and say 10 months is no good, 6 months is. I think it's important, but I think there is more here that distinguishes this from being a course of conduct than simply time. There is time, and there are the differences in the manner and method and circumstances of the killings, the nature of the victim. All those things, it seems to me, go together to saying why I think this is not properly a full course of conduct.
Counsel, what about the motivation of the defendant as being a link in a course of conduct? Would that not be one of the pivotal bases for the designation of course of conduct? In this particular case, the admission that whenever he had a taste for violence or blood or however he phrases it, he has to take care of that business. And here, that seemed to be the thread that ties the murders together, and I'd like to hear you address motivation.
Well, I guess the answer is, at some point, and each of these is also a rape murder, and you know, I mean, at some point, yes, what he wanted to do in each case, I suppose, is rape somebody, and you know, if you've got somebody who has over a span of time, killed somebody during one kind of a robbery one day, and then under another theft circumstance, kills somebody else. That's not this case, obviously, but kills somebody else. I suppose you can find a similar motivation there. I mean, at least you could describe it that way. And I guess I come back to the same thing. I know I don't think motivation, I don't think it's enough to lift this into the world of being a course of conduct. Are there linkages among these crimes? Of course there are linkages.
Counselor, isn't motivation basically, I would view motivation as the impetus for the conduct. You don't conduct yourself without motivation to commit an act. And here, his motivation is what he, you know, confessed it to be. And I would think that motivation would be one of the strongest links in determining whether or not this is a course of conduct.
Well, I can understand that, and I guess I think I don't dispute that it has relevance to the question.
And is not the motivation, by your client's own admission, the same in each one of these murders?
I don't know that he said at one point, the record indicates that he did say at one point, yes, that he has this from time to time. But, you know, I'm not sure that I don't know, and I would have to go back and look at the record to see, but I believe that he does not say, when he says that, he does not say, and it happened on that occasion, and it happened on that occasion, and it happened. I don't know that he specifically tied that drive to each of these separate crimes. But let's assume that he did. Let's assume that he did, because I suppose you can certainly infer that from the record if it's not precisely what it says. And again, I would never dispute that that's relevant to the question of whether we have a course of conduct. I think there are other things that are relevant to it also. And you know, I mean, you are the justices here, and you're going to make the decision about this. But it seems to me that there is enough here to distinguish these things, to say that no, this is not properly viewed as a single course of conduct.
Counsel, what is what's the biggest stretch that we've given the course of conduct so far? Is it the Scott case?
Might be. You've stretched it out to about 4 or 5 months in cases, but in cases where we've had continuing activities over that period of time. What distinguishes this from the other lengthy course of conduct cases that you've had, none this lengthy, but what distinguishes this is the gap between events. And you don't have a gap between events like this not only of this length, but of anything even remotely comparable to this length in any of your prior cases.
And if we were to agree with you with respect to the attempted murder and the later murder, would we be required to order a new trial from the standpoint of sentencing?
I think there are two things follow from that. If you accept my premise about the course of conduct, then two things follow. One is that there is something wrong with the weighing process as it was put to the jury to do, as the judge did it, as the trial judge did it, as the Court of Appeals did it, because they accumulated the weight of all of these events, the four events in determining the course of conduct specifications and the weight to give to them and the balance of aggravation and mitigation. The other thing that it does is it affects the severance question.
The what?
The severance question is the subject of the third proposition of law and also the fourth. Because if these are properly separate offenses, if it's all part of a course of conduct, then I can't disagree that the evidence of each one has to come in the same trial. Because the jury needs to know what the course of conduct is. They're going to have to deal with that question. That necessarily would seem to follow. But if, in fact, the course of conduct is only the two girls, then there's no need there's no need in the trial of the two girls for the evidence of these other crimes to come in. If the evidence of the other crimes doesn't come in, and that was the that's the basis of the severance issue, is separate these things out. The girls go together, the other two don't. And so what we have is, it raises the question of whether improper other acts evidence comes in. And if that's the case, then we go back and not just undo the sentence and the verdict, but go back and undo the whole trial, because the jury was prejudiced by, we would argue, the cumulative weight of all this stuff, all this prejudicial and ultimately, we would argue, irrelevant stuff in the trial of the two girls.
What about the Alton Coleman case? That was done over several years, and for different motives. He killed sometimes for theft, sometimes rape, etc. How is that different than this?
There are at least two differences. First of all, the actual period of time that this court addressed the course of conduct within the Coleman case was a span of several months rather than several years, and it was a period of a crime spree. What you don't have there is this gap between events, this large gap of time when we don't know what he was doing, obviously, but
well, the gap, it doesn't seem that great to me. Some were done in 92, some were done early 93.
Well, I mean, there is a span of more than a year. Now, is that a relevant consideration? Obviously, I'm standing here and I'm telling you I think it is a relevant mm-hmm. consideration. And once again, I don't get a vote in the long run here. But I think it is, and, you know, I mean, it's...
Counselor, I want to back you up to what has to happen, because I'm only one vote, and I've written on course of conduct, and I've dissented because I think we have gotten too expansive. So I might be persuaded by that argument, but I'm having trouble being persuaded that it would require a new trial. I thought the evidence with respect to the two little girls was overwhelming.
I'm not disputing that.
So why a new trial?
Well, okay, here's what happens. If you separate this out, if in fact the evidence of the killing of Belinda Anderson and Hazel Pearson, the adult women, or the attempted killing of Hazel Pearson, if that evidence does not come in the trial regarding the girls, then the evidence, the vast majority of the evidence involving the killing of the girls, comes from this string of participants. Participants and hangers-on in those gang offenses. People who carry with them enormous evidentiary baggage. And not just of that sort, I mean, their own multiply conflicting stories and this version and that version, and they're bad witnesses. Now, there's a bunch of them. I certainly can see that. There's a bunch of bad witnesses, and I'm not disputing that I couldn't stand here and make a sufficiency argument and say, well, the evidence would simply be insufficient. What I would say is that the evidence regarding Mr. Sapp's role in those killings, that he was the ringleader of this gang, that he's the one who caused this, and that evidence is very tenuous, resting pretty much entirely on two things. One, he did this other stuff, and two, what these, frankly, not particularly reliable, credible, appealing witnesses, all of whom were taking deals and had some motivation to tell stories in the way that the state would have liked to have had them told, did, and I think under those circumstances, while the totality of the evidence, when you bring in these other crimes, becomes very weighty on the killing of the girls, I think it's less so. And certainly it's less so regarding the role of Mr. Sapp, and substantially less so if you don't bring that other stuff in. So if that stuff is properly excluded from the calculus, if that stuff is properly left out of the calculus on the aggravated murder counts for the killing of the girls, then what I would suggest is that it is at least reasonable to imagine that the outcome might be different, that there is some significant basis for thinking that, and that under those circumstances, we have some real doubt about that verdict, in which case we send the case, in which case it seems to me that what we do is we send the case back for a new trial on the, for separate trials, and we say, okay, go back, have the separate trials, then see what happens. If you go back and have the separate trials, of course, then you don't have the problem of what would happen if you simply reverse the death sentences either. I have to kind of toss that in. These are old crimes, and we would no longer have that issue would not arise. He would once again be subject to death, which, you know, would be whatever the, if it comes down to it, and if he were tried again, and if he were convicted of aggravated murder and specifications, and if the jury decided, and so on and so forth. But obviously that's a question of how that plays itself out.
He would be subject to death in two separate cases.
Yes. With a total of three counts. I mean,
right.
Belinda Anderson would retain a death specification for felony murder, for the rape. The girls, we would still have the felony murders, and a death specification for a course of conduct for the killing of the two of them at one time, multiple murder.
Okay, now let me push you to
sure.
Something else. Isn't it ineffective assistance of appellate counsel to argue that he should be retried completely rather than that he should simply be sent back for resentencing?
I find myself in an awkward position answering that question. It seems to me that there are multiple remedies that are available to the court. And if, assuming that you accept the proposition that there's a problem to begin with, there are multiple remedies available to the court. This court has made it clear that one cannot accuse oneself of ineffectiveness, and I would be here. You're asking me if I would do that. No, I'm not quite going to say that, although I suppose the argument might be made. As an opponent of the death penalty, I might like it better if you just reversed the sentence in this case. But I think there is a reasonable argument to be made for saying that a proper remedy would be to do more and reverse the convictions. And as the representative of my client who must find things to suggest that it would be appropriate to do, I think the answer is, as an officer of the court, yes, there are several appropriate things for you to do. And it would be your wisdom to pick and choose among them. And I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Gamso. Mr. Shoemaker.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Stephen Shoemaker. I'm the prosecuting attorney of Clark County. Mr. Pickering is my co-counsel. Since the argument is centered on course of conduct, I anticipate taking up all or most of the time. And may it please the court, Mr. Gamso. What is before the court in this particular case, and I will use a phrase that I refrained from using in the trial of this case, is what is the relationship on what the literature labels as a disorganized serial sexual killer and course of conduct as it's set forth in our Ohio Revised Code. Now, if you're looking for authority within the code and within the rules, course of conduct is used in two different places. One is in our venue statute, Ohio Revised Code, section 2901.12. In that statute, a continuing course of criminal conduct is referred to, and specific means are set forth by the legislature as to how that is established. At least three of those criteria are met in this particular case. Subsection 1, the offenses involve the same victim, victims of the same type or from the same group. The offenses were committed as part of the same purpose or objective. And 3, the offenses were part of the same or similar modus operandi. So there, at that point in time, unlike what Mr. Gamso said, the legislature has set forth that there is a relationship, a very direct relationship between modus operandi and course of conduct. And if you're reading these statutes in pari materia, that is extremely, extremely relevant. Now let's go down to some of the points. Mr. Gamso indicates that there is a difference in the victims here. I would tell you that there is Of course, in any set of victims, there will be some differences, but what are the common characteristics? And what are the common characteristics here are you have women or young women that are, for some reason or another, in extremely vulnerable circumstances. Why does that occur? Because in a disorganized serial sexual killer, the killer does not go out on a specific night after a specific victim at a specific place. That type of killer is looking for a victim's of opportunity, and that's what Mr. Sapp did here. That is a common theme amongst his victims.
Counsel, you use that term as a term of art. I'm unfamiliar with it. Is that a term that is referred to in the literature?
Yes, Your Honor. I would refer you to two works. One, the Crime Classification Manual of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It sets forth classifications and criteria for virtually every type of homicide that has been researched in the history of criminal investigation.
Is that cited in your brief?
No, sir. Right. I would also refer you to sexual homicide, patterns and motives.
If you want to submit supplemental authority, you have to submit that to the clerk's office. So Mr. Gamzo has a chance. He hasn't had a chance to respond to this.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And I can do that. I was simply responding from a question from the justice.
You had your books ready there.
Yes, sir. Just in case, Your Honor.
Yeah,
okay. So far, you've pointed to the books. They use that term?
Absolutely. It is a specific term of art, a disorganized serial sexual killer. Now, Mr. Gamzo also pointed out that there were differences as far as the bodies. Martha and Free were covered. In fact, the record will show that there was a specific course of conduct in which the crime scene was cleaned up, in which the bodies were covered both with pallets and with branches at the direction of Mr. Sapp. And that is important because one of the things that is another characteristic, and that what you can see from the record here, is Mr. Sapp, as part of his motivation, is control, is total control, domination, and manipulation of his victims. In this particular case, he had others who were there to assist him, if you will, in that. And these were victims of opportunity. These were victims that Mr. Sapp came across. He had, the record will show you, Your Honor, he had a relationship due to his brother with individuals who were mentally slow. In fact, some of the other individuals that were involved were, in fact, mentally retarded. And he was able to complete that control and manipulation. Now, as to when we get to Belinda, as with Free and Martha, significant post-mortem activity. When we get to Belinda, once again, significant post-mortem activity, indicating a common motivation, a common purpose, and in that particular case, of course, the body was buried. Now, we get to Hazel. And in Hazel's case, Hazel was stuffed under a loading dock in an area that has very little activity. The body was, in fact, covered, but their evidence was at that particular crime scene, even though he had started to clean up the crime scene, he had removed weapons to a place, he had cleaned up some of the evidence, but the evidence indicates, as set forth in the record, that he was disturbed in some manner and had to flee that scene before everything was done. But when we go back and the motivation in all of these homicides, Mr. Gamzo referred to the pants and how they were cut. This is not a small detail because this indicates the fantasy, the motivation that's going on with Mr. Sapp. His motivation is just not to rape. His motivation is not just to kill. His motivation with these pants is to spend a significant amount of time, in most cases, pre-mortem, when the victims are completely disabled, so as to further terrorize them. In fact, he says that in his own statement, that there was a look of terror on Martha's face as he cut those pants. And I encourage the court.
Were the pants all cut in the same place? I took it that they were down the side. Is that right? Or?
They were. I invite the court to get the exhibits out and look at them. It is a very, very specific manner in which the seam goes across the abdomen and down the interior seams to where the pants are opened up. In fact, in his statement, which once again goes to motivation, in his statement, he indicated to Chief Moody, who's here in the courtroom today, that he did this because it was like opening up a Christmas present. To him, this had a specific fantasy purpose. And that is completely unaffected by a lapse of time. And in answer to Justice O'Donnell's question, in this particular type of homicide that is motivated for these reasons, whether the gap is a day, whether it is a week, whether it is a year, whether it is longer, the motivation is the same. The modus operandi is the same. It was indicated that the types of wounds were different. Not so, Your Honors. In Bill Sapp's case, there is always, when Bill Sapp kills, he uses massive blunt head trauma. Now, he also has this thing going on with knives that he uses to cut the pants, and with Hazel, he did evolve to also cutting her throat. But if you look at all of these victims, you will find that essentially their face and or their skulls are eggshelled from numerous, numerous blows to the head. And then they are disabled. There's this significant activity that's spent with them. He admits that with Belinda Anderson, he did exactly the same thing as to the pants.
Mr. Shoemaker, let me take you back to this time element. I take it, Mr. Gamzo, I think it seemed to me, at least I took it from his response, that it probably would not be fruitful for us to try to write a bright line test for the time lapse between the earlier crimes and our conduct and the conduct in the case before us. Is that your opinion?
I don't believe when you're talking about this type of sexual killer that the time lapse gives you any guidance whatsoever. I think you have to look at the individual case as to what is going on in the individual case. And here, clearly, from the evidence in the record, the motivation is the same, the modus operandi is the same, and he is doing the exact same type of wound and weapons as to all of the victims. And in fact, another similarity that you will find with Free and Martha, he lives, according to the record, he lives right down the street from this crime scene. He is about a block and a half away, right next to a very popular bakery in Springfield, Ohio. So every time he walked down the street, he could look at that area of the pond and he could relive what he had done. When you get to Belinda, he had moved at that point in time and literally he could look out his back window down an alley and look at the garage from his own house where he had killed Belinda, and he could relive what he did each and every time. If he went outside his house and walked one block the other way, he could look down on the site, toward the site where he had victimized Hazel Pearson. This is not a coincidence. This is because it is course of conduct. This is because of what he is doing and how he is doing it.
Counsel, you seem to understand an awful lot about the personal thoughts of this person. I want to take you back to our cases that we've decided so far. I dissented in Scott. And is this a better case for course of conduct than Scott? Or
quite frankly, Justice Pfeiffer, I don't know how you could get a better case for course of conduct. And what the facts show here, and what I have not said yet, as far as how it relates to course of conduct, comes out of the mouth of Bill Sapp himself and those some 13 hours of videotape. Very early in the videotape, he made the statement to the officers in referring to Hazel. He said, the bitch needed to die. But then he follows up and said, all the bitches needed to die. Later on, he goes into the motivations about what he was doing, how long it took him, the very minutes that it took him to meticulously cut these pants open. This is not a rash, hurried thing. This, the way he describes it, it's a very deliberate, very thing that he's tunneled in, and he says it was just like opening a Christmas present. Some kids tear it open. Me, as a kid, I used to make sure to take the tape off, unfold it fold by fold.
So, and to you, if the motivation or the modus of the crime is the same, that is course of conduct, period. It's over.
Not necessarily. I would say it's course of conduct when you are talking about a serial sexual killer that is of this type, because unlike a disorganized serial sexual killer, waits for victims of opportunity. So we can't put a definite time limit as to when he is going on in the course of his life and comes across this victim of opportunity. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's open-ended, but I think that the last consideration here is time. I think you have to look at what's going on, and this record,
you seem to be saying the only consideration is if he went through the same thought process, had the same motivation, that's it. That's course of conduct.
And acted in precisely the same way, Your Honor, in precisely the same type of location, precisely the same type of victim, precisely the same type of weaponry, precisely wanting to open that Christmas present.
That's all is method and means of committing the crime. So that's it to you. So why wouldn't the legislature say that instead of using the words course of conduct?
Actually, I think they did in 290112, Your Honor. The legislature said in 290112.5 that a prima facie case of continuing course of criminal conduct is established if the offenses involve the same or similar modus operandi. And here, and with his pattern, it goes beyond his individual acts. It goes to location. Everything is the same. I don't see how it could not be, Your Honor.
But 12 is a venue?
Yes, sir.
Statute?
Yes, sir. There is no case that I could locate, either as to Criminal Rule 8 joinder or as to the venue statute, in which there's ever been a definitive time limit set on course of conduct. If the legislature had intended that, they could simply have said same transaction. They could have said spree killer. They could have said any of these things. They did not. They set forth some indications here if you're reading these statutes in pari materia. But in this particular case, anything that Bill Sapp does, because he's always going to kill the same way. He's always going to kill close to his home. He's always going to kill with blunt trauma. He's always going to open those pants the same way. I don't know of, I can't really conceive, Your Honor, of any better evidence of course of conduct when you are this specific and you have, according to the record, an utter hatred of women. And even in his testimony, even in his tape, he sets forth the course of conduct.
Mr. Shoemaker, when does an individual who kills more than one person become a serial killer, in your view?
Well, that's defined in the literature, and I'll try to stay away as much of that as possible. But it goes into the types of motivations, the type of killing. I mean, it's in theory possible for someone to hold up a liquor store and kill someone and then go out and do a sexual killing. Highly unlikely. But in this particular case, I think it's clear.
Okay. You think it's a case-by-case basis, what you're saying?
I believe so, Your Honor. In fact, I believe that under the instructions that have been crafted, it's largely a jury question. Of course, the courts can attempt to further define those, the jury instructions that go to the jury, and that's certainly within your province to do so. The jury instructions here seem to be pretty well modeled after 290112 and what's in the, I believe, what's in the OJI.
Thank you.
This defendant never committed any other crimes in his lifetime.
Yes, Your Honor. And before we actually tried him on this, I tried him on a case that preceded this particular case. In that particular case, he picked up a prostitute, took him out in a field right across the street from his home. Once again, he had moved, and he moved to another location to commit his crime. He took her in that field. He once again began the blunt trauma. Stabbed her through the face with his knife, continuing and developing his knife fetish, and attempted to rape her from behind, at which time she kicked him, and his pants were down around his ankles, and she was able to run bleeding with head trauma to Interstate 70, where bypassers picked her up. The Sheriff's Department were later able to solve that crime, and he was convicted in that particular case of felonious assault and kidnapping, and which led to the further investigation of him for these crimes. There's also evidence, Your Honor, that the state of Florida did not proceed, but in the initial record in this case, you would see that he also confessed to a homicide in the 1980s. A woman that was blunt trauma, I believe to the head by a dumpster, by his apartment in Jacksonville, Florida. He's also been incarcerated down in Florida on an aggravated assault situation. So we have other crimes they're developing. In this particular case, when Jacksonville came up to speak with him after he was tried for the rape and kidnapping and felonious assault of Una Timmons, that's when it first came up to those officers and to the Springfield police officers about Hazel Pearson. And as soon as that came up, those officers and, of course, my office were aware of the pants that were cut off Hazel Pearson. And that was a signature. That is an absolute signature of his crimes. And we knew, even though the other crime had occurred, I think some 14 months earlier, that we knew that there had to be a link. And of course, then the DNA testing was done, and that linked him with the girls. So at the very beginning, even though they were talking about a crime down in Florida that they didn't know would be related, the signature evidence with Hazel Pearson came into effect. And I implore you, Justice, take those pants out of the exhibit. Hold them up. Look at them. Look at the pants from Free and Martha. And that is almost it's an exhibit of course of conduct. It just is.
Well, it's an exhibit of course of conduct if the method and means of committing the crimes are all you need.
Method, means, motivation.
I mean, I don't need to take the pants out and look at them. If I follow where you would have us go, then you've got that in spades.
We believe so, Your Honor. We believe so. The only question, at least I'm interpreting from some of your questions, is that whether a time period arbitrarily changes what is going on in a case, what is going on in the mind and the actions of a defendant. Does time period alone break a course of conduct? And what I'm attempting to tell this court, in the case of this kind of sexual killer, that simply would not be logical. I cannot believe that the legislature would ever have intended for a 13-month span to not be a course of conduct when everything is the same versus a 6-month span versus a 2-month span. I cannot find the logic in that, Justice Pryor.
So you would, it seems from your argument, you would agree that course of conduct simply doesn't involve killing two or more people. It has to involve similar, as you say, modus operandi, a similar fact situation, similar pattern, something that's factually similar other than the fact that two people were killed.
And I believe this court has so held in the past when there's been challenges to the court course of conduct specification as to vagueness. I believe this court has held that, and I would, of course, agree with that. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Shoemaker. Mr. Pickering. I think Mr. Pickering. Pardon?
I will not be presenting any argument.
Oh, okay. Mr. Gamza, you saved a little over 7 minutes of your time.
Thank you. And I apologize for jumping up before.
Yeah, I had checked in as wanting to argue, so that's why I called in.
I can't speak to the whatever it is, disorganized, serial, sexual killer, whatever that diagnosis is. I'm not going to try. I'm going to suggest that there is something, and once again, without knowing the literature to which he addresses, and without having had a chance to look at it, the terminology alone, the idea that somehow one can be disorganized and yet engage in organized patterns and courses of conduct seem to me to be contradictory, but then, once again, I don't know exactly.
Counselor, I think the disorganized would refer to the crime of opportunity as opposed to the specificity of identification of a victim. And here, the disorganized goes towards that, and then the sexual serial killer speaks for itself. Now, one thing I'm having a little difficulty with is trying to understand your argument as to time, because that's what you seem to focus on, and the relevance of time to this this case.
Let me try it again. Once again, let me go back to the words course of conduct, which, yes, are defined in the venue statute for venue purposes. They're not defined for purposes of the aggravated murder specification. And nowhere in the revised code are they defined for that purpose. And so for that purpose, it seems to me that we have to do is we have to go back and do what you do with an undefined term. A term that's not defined in the revised code, which is it means it's ordinary common sense usage, and that basically applies to what this court has said about it before. You know, the course of conduct specification applies to those things which it fairly describes. Okay, so if I'm right about that, about the way of looking at it, that the venue definition simply doesn't apply here, then the question is, what is a course of conduct? And what I have to suggest, what seems to me to be right, is it's not something which just happens to happen more than once. We're not just talking about somebody who has killed twice under remarkably different circumstances decades apart, but because this is not that. This is not that, obviously. But there is a gap here, certainly, and a gap substantially larger than any that this court has previously addressed. And I think there is a relevance to that. When we talk about a course of conduct, it seems to me that term suggests, in ordinary parlance, to the ordinary person, what it fairly describes is something that continues, not something that occurs, and then sometime later, quite a while later, actually, occurs again, or something like it occurs again, or something sort of like it occurs again. And then perhaps at some future time, something like it happens again. I think that's not a course of conduct. That may be, I don't know, I'm not going to come up with a name for it, but that's not what the ordinary sense of the term course of conduct would be. And when the term is not defined for purposes of this section in the revised code, that's where we look to, is the ordinary meaning of the term, not the meaning of the term as we might derive it from some book by FBI analysts, and not the term as it might be defined in the venue statute.
Counsel, what does it mean, course of conduct being that crime was committed generally in the same way each time?
Not
getting into time factors, just the mechanism of the crime, be it 2 weeks or a year and a half, but the crime being committed in the same type of manner each time.
I would suggest I think that's probably relevant to the question. I think it's probably relevant to the question. I don't think it's dispositive. And I think at some point, and once again, I don't want to offer bright line rules. I don't have one for you. But at some point, time gaps become meaningful. 25 years between crimes? I don't know.
So,
1 year? 10 months? 6 months?
Basically, you're saying that if you have the similar, you can point to motivation, you can point to method, you can point to commonality between the victims and the circumstances and the aftermath. Time will trump all of those?
No, I'm not saying that.
I am having difficulty in understanding your focus on time as the weight or the importance that you are attaching to that when we have all of these other similarities, all of these other factors present in this case. How does time trump everything else that is in front of us?
Well, first of all, I don't think the victims are all similar. I understand that we've been told the victims were all nearby somehow, or at least the crime scenes were all nearby. So I guess the victims were nearby at the time of the crime, and I understand that they were all female, but in fact, two of them are girls, two of them are adults, and we're talking little girls and not young adults. And the circumstances, I would suggest, are in fact different. And while there are similarities, I won't dispute that there are similarities. That would be nonsense. There are similarities. These are not the identical crimes. They are the identical cuts in the pants. I won't disagree about that. But they are not identical crimes. Beyond that, there are similarities. There are also differences. When you add the differences together with the big thing that is that time gap, which is unusual and non-existent in the rest of this court's jurisprudence on the subject, then I think it is the package. It happens that the time gap is something that we've never addressed here. Dissimilarities in circumstance you have addressed before. And I am out of time. I would ask you to reverse something.
Thank you, Mr. Gamzo. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.